Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to The Game, the podcast that delves into the most intriguing talking points in football today. I'm your host, Rob Fletcher, and today we're talking about football analytics and data. So the question that we've come up with for this week is football becoming too data-driven? And we're feeling so ambitious with this one that we're adding a second question, are data and analytics stripping the game of its artistry and spontaneity? To get stuck into the spreadsheets with me is TFT member Matthew Gibbs. Hello, Matthew.
Hello, Rob. Thanks for having us.
I think it's going to be an interesting discussion and probably going to be another wide-ranging discussion, as most of these episodes end up being. Hopefully, we don't come to the usual conclusion of it's all about money, which has been pretty much all of the other conclusions to every episode, and maybe we will. But to kind of kick us off, we're going to talk all data and all analytics as we go through, and certainly as a youngster playing Championship Manager and into Football Manager, I have seen numbers pretty much all of my football fandom, whether it's influence, set pieces, injury proneness, shooting. I remember the outrage when shooting became finishing in Championship Manager, and it was like, what does this mean? Like, what is finishing? How is it different to shooting? But I've been around numbers all the time that I've been supporting football, really, looking at football league tables, top scorers charts. What's your kind of data history or numbers history, shall we say, with the game?
Exactly the same. I've been playing Championship Manager, Football Manager since, do you remember back in, was it the late 90s, early 2000s, when you used to get the demo in the catalogs and stuff like that? So ever since then, always been into it. Never been able to interpret data in the way that Football Manager, the game, wants you to now. But now it's very complicated, and the stuff that you can delve into is very intense. But I have always been interested and quite fascinated by statistics and how they've come to shape modern sport. I'm a big fan of American sports as well, and I like baseball and NFL especially. And in those, the way that figures are used in scouting, in training, in health and nutrition, and especially by punditry and commentators over there, I think is something that football, soccer, English coverage has yet to match, really. I think we're still quite far behind in that regard. It is quite daunting, though, especially if you're watching sort of American coverage of stuff when you're just faced with acronyms and numbers and not much else, and they can talk. It's like a different language. It's a skill, and I think it's a skill that is still quite new to football over here, really, and still something that is still yet to, I think we've yet to see the full effects it has on modern football.
Yeah, definitely. And I think as a 15-year veteran of ESPN NBA fantasy, I can very much vouch for the amount of numbers and data that's used in basketball and how that's been used to kind of advance players' careers is what I would say, probably more than anything else. So obviously a basketball game is 48 minutes, but the average kind of playing time if you're a starter is about 36 minutes. So one of the things that they do is they'll extrapolate your averages out to a per 36-minute basis to kind of get an idea of what you might be like if we give you more playing time. So I don't know, if you're a reserve and you play 18 minutes and you score 10 points, you can extrapolate that. Well, actually, they might score 20 points a game and get 10 rebounds or whatever. And I think the idea behind that of, we can see this player might be undervalued because they're not getting enough minutes and they're going to be more productive. Like you say, I don't know whether we've seen that yet in football. There's a lot of per 90 stuff that you see a lot of the time, which kind of pops up quite regularly, but certainly American sports are very different. In terms of like data and analytics used in TV and the TV coverage, obviously we've seen a very different thing. Jamie Carragher did a whole piece on Brentford on Monday Night Football talking about XG, and he actually had players at various points on the pitch with the relevant XG if they were going to take a shot from that point and how they were trying to improve the XG. Basically, the closer you are to the goal, the higher the XG. It's pretty straightforward. I've got a point about XG that I stole from somebody else that I'll make as well in a sec. But I think a lot of it is quite interesting. So Ted Knutson, who was the owner of StatsBomb, he just sold it. He was saying, yeah, it was great analysis from Jamie Carragher. I was talking about this with Brentford in 2017. So actually, that kind of element has been around for a long time, and a lot before we've seen it on TV. But the thing about XG was, which we'll definitely talk about, is a lot of football fans talk about, that was a 50-50 chance, that. Oh, okay, so that's a 0.5 XG then. He'll score that 9 times out of 10. Okay, I mean, so that's a 0.9. It's just maths. It's just a different way of expressing the maths, isn't it?
Yeah, it's always been around. We've always had that sort of that terminology, the sort of football cliches way of talking about the sport. It's always been sort of part and parcel of it. I think it's been a lot more prevalent in sport than most people realise. I mean, there's quite a lot of, when they brought in XG a few years ago, there was a lot of people not understanding it or pushing against it. And it's like, all it is just telling, it's just putting a number on how good the chance is. It doesn't do anything more than that. You can take it or leave it as you want, but it's just that 50-50 chance that you said is a 50-50 chance. It has a number. It's 0.5. So yeah, it's just putting numbers on stuff that's always been around, really.
Yeah, and I think that there's always the trepidation around changes in sport and developments, and obviously it might make people feel threatened or whatever. I mean, for me, obviously a lot of it comes out as like individual games. You know, Arsenal got 2.1 XG and Brentford got 0.5, but Brentford won 1-0. What does that tell me? It's like, well, it probably tells you that Arsenal were unlucky to lose the game, is what it tells you. It's those things. And actually looking at it over a longer period of time, it's always going to be more beneficial. Other things around sort of data analysis, that it's maybe probably more in the public eye with websites like FB Ref that have got a basketball one. I think they've got a baseball one, haven't they, where they've basically collects all the statistics and data. And there's...
The baseball ones are something else. That is a sport that has been surrounded by numbers since like for 50 years. And how it took someone until like, what was it, the late 90s for Moneyball to kick in, late 90s, early 2000s for that to kick in is astonishing, really, when you look at the sort of the statistics they collect and collate every single season. It's a lot.
It's crazy that at the time, it seems really revolutionary. Within 5 years, everybody's doing it. I think that's a very interesting thing about sport development. It's a bit like marginal gains, isn't it, with the British cycling team. All of a sudden, a school is getting marginal gains, a supermarket's getting marginal gains based on, you know, workers' performance or whatever. It's just, it kind of infiltrates quite a lot of what goes on. I do think with football, you know, there was Hughes and Reap who kind of talked about the position of maximum opportunity and all that sort of stuff, where they had, you know, 7 passes before you should shoot is the optimum amount. Therefore, you should be trying to get the ball forward as quickly as possible. That was data that was maybe trying to affect the game. People like Steve McLaren and Sam Allardyce were using sort of ProZone type software, you know, early in the 2000s. And then Middlesbrough and Bolton sides both got into Europe. Middlesbrough, obviously my team, we got into a European final. They were using some of that data to help them. But I think a lot of that was around fitness. I could be wrong with that, but a lot of it, especially because Allardyce used to squeeze out 30 games a season from Campo, Djorkaeff, Hierro, Okocha, because of, you know, whatever they were using. And now we see players who are wearing the sort of like under the shirt packs that have got like tracking the movement and that kind of thing.
See, that sort of stuff is fascinating, because I don't know if you've read Rory Smith's, he's got a book about sort of not about analytics, like the history of analytics in football.
Yeah, expected goals, I think. Is it called expected goals? I think, yeah.
Expected goals, yeah. And there's a bit in that where talking about how Sam Allardyce was one of the first to use it and very sort of positively used it in terms of set pieces. But there's other, I want to say it's that Ted Knutson guy who says that it's actually set pieces are not that, they're not profitable in football. It's like you'll score from them like 0.18% of the time. And so you're better off redirecting that effort into maximizing that elsewhere on the pitch, because it's just not worth your time. Which is fascinating, because it just goes to show that you can bring in these statistics, you can bring in different models and all that sort of stuff, but it's how you interpret it and how you use that to gain that marginal advantage that we've been talking about. And I get part of that as well. I think we're still yet to see how a lot of statistics is very post haste. It's very sort of this happened during a game, this is why it happened, all that sort of stuff. But how people are using statistics to affect a game in advance, and to say, I guess the difference I find with other sports is that football is fluid and it's constantly moving and happening. Whereas other sports, like the American examples, baseball, the NFL, it's very much a limited amount of time that the thing will happen and then we go again. the baseball, there's a man with a stick and there's a guy throwing it, and that's what happens. And then you move on to the next play. It's play by play, whereas football is fluid, and why they've still yet to generate statistical value for stuff like momentum and confidence and look and how that sort of things can affect a game. And there's so much secrecy around it as well. Like you said, that Brentford have been talking about this XG and these sort of the positions where you're on the pitch back in 2016, and it didn't come out for however many years until not too long ago. It's the thing compared to baseball. They all the baseball sides have their own analytical departments who develop their own models, and they interpret that in different ways to help that side. A big thing this last season with the Chicago White Sox, who turns out they didn't have an analytical department despite all the, you know, the advances there's been, and they had a record-breaking terrible season because they didn't take advantage of that. They don't have their own people working on the numbers to make it work for them. And there's sort of similar things in football, I guess, where I know we said it all comes down to, you know, who's got the most money, but the richest teams will have the best analytical departments that can help them, you know, progress to the next stage.
Yeah, definitely. There's a couple of points you made there, and one about the corners specifically. How many fans curse the corner taker if they play it short? But actually, really, they're just trying to create a better attacking opportunity based on what the data has told them from past matches. You know, if you're only going to score from one out of every 50 corners or whatever it might be, actually, if I do a short corner and change the angle of the cross, or you work a little passage of play where you can dribble past a few people for a cutback to five people in the box, if they get a shot off, you're probably more likely to score than, you know, from a centre-half heading the ball in. And do you know what? Teams that do it well, a team like Arsenal, who are becoming a bit of sort of a set-piece specialist in terms of their team, maybe Brentford as well, if you can get it right, you're obviously going to have an advantage over others, but you're getting that right because you might have a deficiency somewhere else. So actually, you might not score as many from open play, but you know you can score 10 corner goals from corners, so you only need to score 30 more goals in the season. You know what I mean? So it's kind of, it builds that in.
I was going to say, Arsenal fans weren't like that.
Well, you know, if they had a proper function attack, they might not need to score from all the set pieces, might they? But it is that thing of, actually, Guardiola did it a lot, didn't he, at Barcelona, where he kind of was thinking, I don't want to cross it in. I haven't got the players to head the ball in. But what I have is players who can dribble and players who can play in small spaces. So I want to try and manipulate the game so that I've got more of those opportunities than not. It just makes total sense.
And correct me if I'm wrong, he's not someone who's used a lot of data analytics. Like, he's not someone who leans very heavily on the statistics. And yet he's come to the same conclusion that the last 20 years of statistics has, in that get closer to the goal, you've got a better opportunity, a better chance of scoring.
Massively, and a lot of his play is built around a 3-2-5 formation, which was, you know, inverting the pyramid by Jonathan Wilson's, in my head, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, probably. Maybe even before that. And he builds up through that. So he's using a 100-year-old formation to get the ball as close to the goal as is humanly possible, which at the end of the day, winning the football match is the point, isn't it? So I think if we think about, you know, our question is around, is football becoming too data-driven, too analytical? We've talked about how, you know, playing Championship Manager and Football Manager, we've seen a lot of numbers and a lot of data. What we've probably seen more of in terms of a data point of view, if we look at players first, is more information available about players, about, you know, where they play, how many games. On a basic level, where have they played, how many games they've played previously, and how many goals they've scored. Because as anyone will know, and from myself writing about the 90s, you had to buy the sort of Rothman's Guide or the European Handbook or whatever, because that was where all of the statistics were held a lot of the time before, you know, things were online, things were on the internet. I would probably say that's where there's been the biggest use of data, and possibly where fans will look to if they get linked with a player. You know, what's his goals record, his assist record? Is he overperforming his XG or underperforming? That is probably the area, isn't it, that we see the most data probably used in football more than the gameplay?
Yeah, I think that's the most widely available and the most easy to interpret, because reading numbers and reading data and reading analytics is a skill. And it's kind of amazing, really, that so many of us who are sports fans are able to do that in a way without any, you know, professional or technical training, where we you look at numbers and interpret them and create a narrative from it, and you can interpret how good or bad a player is from, you know, checking these sort of statistics. But yeah, they're the ones that have been most available throughout, you know, the last, how long do you say, like 40, 50 years? And I have to admit, I don't actually know when these sort of statistics started being recorded. I'm sure they didn't record assists and stuff like that in the 70s or 80s. It must have come like 80s, 90s, I think.
Yeah, I think assists were recorded a lot later. And I do know that Opta went back and did a lot of projects around the World Cups, I think, where they went back and looked at, you know, the goals, assist records of players and people like Pelé and stuff like that who scored, you know, 5,000 goals. Did they actually score 5,000 goals? Or did they actually get like 100 and we just don't know it? So a lot of these things, it's kind of trawling back through archives and working out what it looks like. But from a sort of more data-heavy point of view, for me, I think what fans will look at is, I think a lot of fans will go to numbers first. So they'll quickly, you know, scan the player's Wikipedia, how much, just on the base level, you know, he scored 50 goals in the, I don't know, Romanian Premier League. So, you know, that equates to whatever. And you kind of start thinking, well, what is he like? And then you might be able to find him, like, say, FBref, which is just a massive database of statistics. And you might be able to find out his, how many, you know, I always think when someone's made 50 appearances, how many minutes have they played? You know, were they a sub in 30 of them? And they came on for the last 10 minutes. But in the 20 games they did play, they scored 8 or 9 goals. But the other 30, where they played 10 minutes of time, they scored 3. And I think, well, actually, those 12 goals come in 25 90s, if you like. So actually, it looks a lot better than 15 and 50.
I mean, this is like a Football Manager thing, but like, if you've got a player who scores tons of goals up front, like an Erling Haaland type, if he scores 4 goals in one game and 4 goals in another game and then doesn't score for 10, it's still going to say he scored 8 goals in 12 games. And it looks great on paper, but is that really what the data is showing you? That's why it's important to have people who can interpret that and you know, tell you what it is that you're seeing.
And I think, like you said earlier on, it's very much a retrospective statistic. Like you said there, if we saw that a striker has got 8 in 12, already I'm thinking, well, that's a pretty good return. He's a pretty good player. But then actually you realise that he only scored in 2 games. I think we had this a little bit with Ravanelli at Borough in 96-97. He scored 31 goals that season, 15 in the league and 16 in the cup. But he scored probably 9 in the first 3 rounds of the cup. And he also had a 3-month spell where I think he scored once. And he scored, I think, 2 hat-tricks. So actually, when you look at it, his 31 goals probably came in 15 out of his 50 games. Which is still amazing, but what's he doing the rest of the time?
Yeah.
Because he often wasn't the striker that was maybe contributing to build up or creating other goals or bringing other people into play. So I do think there is that word of warning in terms of how you use that data. And another thing, obviously, is the rise of YouTube and how you look at the data and go, he scored X amount of goals, and then you find the compilation that only shows the best bits, the highlights, the greatest hits, if you like. And as a fan, you add the data that looks good. You know, he's got 15 and 25 90s. You look at he's scoring goals on these highlights. And actually, that's where probably the layman, us as fans, if you like, that's really probably where it ends. Whereas the data and analytics teams, they're watching games. They might go to see them live. They're getting references probably on them as well that we don't see from managers, previous coaches. They might even know previous teammates. They might have a link with the club. They might have worked with them at a different level. So there's actually probably, even when we talk about your data analytics being used to select players, it's only one piece of the puzzle, isn't it?
Yeah. So on this, there's a few, a funny thing. I mean, I think every football fan has a story like this where, what was the season? I want to say 2014-15 or 15-16. I'm a Birmingham City fan, and we signed a lad called Greg Stewart from Scotland. He was playing for, I want to say he's playing for Aberdeen. Probably wrong. And we signed him, and he had a fantastic or pretty solid goals assist ratio in the Scottish Premier League over a couple of years. You look at the YouTube, and the man looks incredible, like amazing first touch, like glides past defenders at ease, and then came to Birmingham and did absolutely sweet fuck all. And it's how you assess the data that you have in front of you to be sure that this person can make the step up to your level. In terms of recruitment, though, I think we've mentioned the baseball already, but Moneyball is a fascinating area and a really interesting discussion to be had when it comes to recruitment. I think it's a bit of a, not a red herring, but it's a bit of a, it's a buzzword these days, where I think why we are still seeing, while there's so much more data analysis and data usage in modern football, we're still not seeing the full effect of what that can do. Because for that to be a success, it needs to have full buy-in from everybody at the club. And I feel that we don't see that often enough. Because if you did, then you'd see teams like Manchester United, who, you know, spend millions and hundreds of millions of pounds every summer. They would be so much better than they are, but they're not. So I think we're going to get, we've mentioned them already, but Brighton and Brentford are probably the two best models of this. And in doing research for this, I saw there is a pretty interesting interview with Brentford's technical director, Lee Dykes, on the Brentford website. I don't know why they're letting this out for the public, but he explains that there's seven stages to that recruitment. And the first stage starts with more than 85,000 players that can cover up to 16 positions on the pitch. And they sort of work inward from that, which includes all sorts of things from what's the priority position they're looking for, comparing players against each other, looking at specific, you know, what specific skills they have. Then they bring these players that they have from that 85,000 to the manager, to the other coaches, to the youth setup, and they narrow it down some more. And then they still have a certain amount of players to select from during that model. And they go from there. And that's how they settled on players like Brian and Mbeumo and some of the sort of really quite impressive transfers that they've made from like quite obscure leagues and making that setup. But, you know, even then, it's still not a guarantee because over the years they've bought a handful of players who haven't made it. So it's not always 100% accurate.
No, I don't think it ever can be. And I think from that Moneyball point, it's an interesting one. And with my very crude understanding of the baseball part of Moneyball, it's effectively if you lost a 20-goal-a-season striker for 20 million, you would buy two 10-goal-a-season strikers for 3 million each. And therefore,
we can recreate them in the aggregate, is the quote.
We've replaced the 20 goals, but we've only spent 6 million, so we're 14 million profit. And I think a lot of what Billy Beane did was out of necessity in terms of finance, wasn't it? Oh, they weren't a really wealthy team. They're in a not a huge market like New York or LA or whatever. So actually, market forces effectively determined what he had to do. Pep doesn't need to use a money ball effect because he's got loads of money. You've still got to buy the right players because Man United have proved you can have all the money in the world and still buy the wrong players. And actually, it's always about getting the right players. And for teams like Brentford and Brighton, the right players have also included coming at a lower price or a more cost-effective price who you can then move on maybe quickly after 2 or 3 years. And Tony Bloom and Matthew Bentham, actually, I think Bentham used to work for Bloom and they were rivals and then they split.
When they work together and now they hate each other or...
Something like that. And Tony Bloom's actually just invested in Hearts, or his data analytics company, are now being used by Hearts to kind of Star Lizard is the name of it, which I think is quite a funny name for a football data analytics company. But they use such different and more wide ranging data than anybody else because, for the best will in the world, Liverpool are not going to go to Ecuador and look to sign a ball winning central midfielder. Because when you can spend 50 to 70 million on someone from Europe, why would you do that? Someone who's already played 50 games in the Champions League, 250 games in the Bundesliga. Why am I wasting my time scouting a 19-year-old in the Ecuadorian League or in Japan or in Bolivia? But actually for Brighton or Brentford, going to Ligue 2 in France and saying, oh, actually, who's that striker who plays for the team who are ninth? His profile looks like it would fit how we want to play. And he's available for 3 million quid. And if we sell him because he's done well, it's because our system shows off his strengths. I think that's one thing that maybe fans don't always think about analytics. The point of the analytics is to find players who have previously shown the skill and ability to play in your system. How many times you see, especially Man United, why have they signed him? He doesn't fit the style. And actually, is that because their analytics team, which I'm sure they have, but not as effective as others, doesn't actually work because maybe they don't know what they want to do. They don't know what the style. So do you think that makes it a little... Because obviously the question is about is sort of football becoming too data-driven. Do you actually think in terms of player recruitment, it's actually a real positive if it becomes data-driven, if you've got a style and you can fit a player who loves to run with the ball, and you play really wingers who cut inside and want to shoot and all that sort of stuff?
No, I think he can be. I think, especially if you're a mid to lower level club. I mean, I hate to put examples on it, but there is a more scope for a low cost, high reward model where you can buy a player from Ligue 2 and give them the time and space to develop and grow into something that's going to be, for all intents and purposes, flip for a profit. Bigger clubs don't really have, in many ways, the bigger clubs don't have that sort of luxury because they need success now. So they need to buy more of a ready-made model that will insert into their system and you know, provide instant benefits. Whereas the Moneyball model to that sort of thing is less about that. It's more about recreating the aggregate for long-term success. It's not necessarily going to happen straight away, but it's one that means, you know, that will provide benefits in the future. I still don't think data has that much say over football as of yet. I still think although it's quite highly prevalent, and we see it mentioned a lot in the media. You see it a lot on Monday Night Football. I think a lot of it is used, not incorrectly, but maybe not used in ways that can be, that provides any more illustrations of the game. I think I don't watch the coverage on Monday Night Football that much. I find it kind of a bit aggravating at times. But there's however many times you watch this, and especially Match of the Day, where they provide, like Alan Shearer will provide some statistical analysis, and you're like, that told you nothing. That tells you nothing about what just happened or the highlights you just watched. It's just meaningless statistics that they seemingly don't know how to interpret in ways that can add more commentary to it. So I still don't think that it's not driving the game as much as it could. And again, using examples of like Manchester United, I mean, they may have their own data analytics department that, you know, tells you to go buy this player, and Erik ten Hag will still turn around and say, no, I want Antony. I want the guy who I've worked with before, and he can do what I want him to do, and it's been a bust. So that's what I mean when I say it needs total buy-in from a club, in that you need the manager to be on board as well. You need the coaches to be on board so they can be like, fantastic, bring us the player, we can work with him. Because if one person sort of steps out of line at that and ruins that flow and ruins that model, then it makes it makes it all not work as well.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think the Moneyball model is a basketball thing. I don't think you can necessarily do it in football in terms of like replace, you know, in the aggregate or whatever you want to call it. But what I do think has happened, and maybe this is where fans of a certain generation, shall we say, may sort of recoil at this acknowledgement of data, especially being used for player recruitment. Actually, when you see a lot of these articles, especially that come out of the local press, you know, when they've got like a new sporting director or they've got a new manager, and they'll say, we want to make sure that we're data driven. What they're actually saying is, we want to stop signing bad players. Because what we used to do is let the manager bring all his boys in and make sure that we had the team that he wanted. And now we can't sell any of them because none of them have got any value, because this manager wanted this to play in this way or this style or whatever. When actually, when you get a sporting director or head of football, they just say, we don't want to waste money anymore. So it's actually what a lot of it comes down to is, yeah, they're using data to do that, but they're just trying to make fewer mistakes. And actually having more information, for me, maybe as a teacher, this is a bias, more knowledge is never a bad thing. Because actually knowing more about a football player before they sign for you, it's got to be a benefit. Because, you know, if there's any red flags, especially with personality.
Better to have that knowledge and not use it than to not have it and then find out something afterwards. And, you know, and I think half the problem with the sort of, you know, your team hires a new sporting director who's going to go back to data. There's no time in football. Like football clubs, even though they may claim to commit to these models, they still don't give them enough time. And we have to use the example of American sports, but the difference is you hire a general manager in American sports, you know he's going to be there for at least 5 years. You know he's going to be there for a long time to build up a database, build up the statistics and the information that they want that can then help you make informed opinions to better your club, to better your organization. You don't get that in football. There's too much turnover, even in terms of general manager. The guy who, I keep forgetting his name, the guy who's, is he West Ham now, the German, is it Tim Steiden? Something like that. He's been around, he's done the clubs. There's the guy, another German guy who, Sven Mislintat, always seems to end up rock up at a club for 6 months and then leaves in, you know, having arguments or whatever. Like, they're not given enough time to lay down that marker and to build their own database to then benefit the club. There's no time in football. Everyone moves too fast.
Yeah, and I think there was even the sort of director of research of Liverpool, Ian Graham, who wrote a book recently about how the data team helped Liverpool win the Premier League. And a lot of that was that we used it, but we didn't use it for everything. Klopp still liked a certain type of player with a certain type of personality and a certain type of style, and nothing would be signed off without Klopp. So actually the manager's there saying, I like this player, I like this player. I don't like him. I don't want to sign him. He's not the man or player for me. So I think it's important that people realise, and you hear it on, you know, when these managers go on podcasts or whatnot, most of the players that join the club, the managers agreed to. So when, you know, whether it's David Moyes at West Ham or whatever, saying, oh, you know, he doesn't look like a David Moyes sign or whatever. He's been signed for Moyes and Moyes has agreed to it. Sometimes, I think we talked about this on the podcast, on this podcast before, like Chelsea signing, you know, X number of players. I actually don't mind how many players they sign under the age of like 20, because the manager, Maresca, is not really going to be there in 3 years' time. But that 18-year-old probably will be, and he might be a really good player. But actually, Maresca probably would never want to bring him in. So that sporting team behind the scenes are actually trying to make sure the club can maintain with new players coming through or whatever.
I think that's the sort of Americanization of football, and quite fascinating, really, where they, you know, you have your general manager and you have your sporting, your head coach or whatever you want to call it. That's the difference, where football used to be, your manager used to be head of the club and he would do everything. Everything would go through him, whereas now there is more of a separation in responsibilities, which I can understand why it leads to arguments, but I think it's the future. I think we're going to see more of that. I don't know if anyone has the term general manager yet in Britain or in European football, but I'm getting close to that, I think.
Yeah, I think it's like sporting director, technical director, head of football, that kind of thing. But I think most clubs now have somebody doing that role, because I think even though there's, you know, plenty of money sloshing around in the Premier League, it's been spent badly for quite a long time. And I actually think the owners are kind of thinking, if I can just get someone as an in-between, like I know, you know, from Borough's point of view before, we had a head of football. It was effectively manager to CEO. That was the chain of command. So if the manager wanted a player and it was within budget and it wasn't kind of unreasonable, the deal got done. So when you've got a Tony Pulis or a Neil Warnock, you're going to end up with, when you sack them, the remnants of a Tony Pulis or a Neil Warnock squad. And the next manager has got to deal with that. They've got to change it. They've got to buy new players, whatever. Whereas now it's more like, this is the style of player we want to play as a club. The manager at the moment is fulfilling that. He's facilitating that. And the players that we buy are fitting into that system. So we're not going to go crazy and start buying a 35-year-old striker just to get us promoted. For better or worse, we're not going to do that, because actually there's no value in it or whatever. So I do think clubs are starting to get wise to that a little bit. The second part of the question was talking about, is it sort of stripping the game of its artistry and of its spontaneity? And I know there's a lot more goals that are scored in the Premier League now. I think it's like 0.8 goals a game more than it was sort of in the mid to late 2000s, so sort of 20 years ago. Do you think that this sort of data approach, whether it's talking about XG or goals prevented or using it for player recruitment, do you feel like it's taken away the artistry and spontaneity out of some players?
No. I think that is sort of going out of the game a little bit, but I don't think it's data's fault. I think it's like we've said, data. People use data just to tell them things that we already knew in a way, but it's most clubs use data analytics there to fill the gaps and to find that extra 5% that will take you to the next level. I still don't think we're at the point yet, except for like Brighton and Brentford, where that data-led approach shapes the entire club. But I do find, maybe because I'm getting old, I don't know, I do find modern football is getting a bit less spontaneous. I think it's a good word for it, and a bit less exciting. And it's just a personal thing. Inverted fullbacks is not really my thing. It's quite an annoying trend that's coming to football. I know my team are playing with it, sort of inverted fullback at the minute. And it's, I don't know, there's something unaesthetically, it doesn't feel right to me as like a tactic. It's not very fun to watch for me. So I don't think I don't think data is what's like stripping clubs of spontaneity. And yeah, I think it's sort of everything else around it, like the how football is becoming sort of, you know, another cog in the capitalist machine is what is crushing clubs. But I'm not sure what's your sort of take on that.
I'm probably similar, actually. I don't think it's robbing any player of spontaneity or any of that sort of artistry. There's an article in The Athletic from Ollie Kerr about nostalgicising the 2000s, basically. And he used the example of Liverpool v Chelsea. Remember they played 6 or 8 games over like a 3-year spell and there's about 4 goals scored in all the games or something ridiculous. I'm obviously exaggerating for a dramatic effect, but it was quite dull. It was really boring because it was two man. I mean, remember Jose every game, they parked the bus. They sat in. The teams are doing that now, but we just call it a low block because park the bus sounds ridiculous, but a low block sounds quite normal from a sporting point of view, just like you would say a long-range shot. Why are we, you know, saying that talking about a low block is so annoying when we talk about long-range shots or set pieces or whatever? It's just the same. But anyway, back to the point about the 2000s. We always think there's more of what we miss now back then, where you say, oh, there's no Ronaldinho playing. And you're like, well, think about all the top class players that we have, you know, like a Salah or De Bruyne or Mane when he was at Liverpool. You've got like Musiala at Bayern Munich. You've got Yamal and Rafinha absolutely tearing teams to shreds at Barcelona. Yeah, there might not be Ronaldinho, but that was because Ronaldinho hadn't really been seen in the 90s. Whereas actually, if you look at some of the players that you've got now, like, I don't know, you like your Van Dijks and people like that, they stand up in any generation. And there's certain an artistry and spontaneity about the goals they score or the way they play. Just because the teams are a little bit more structured in terms of in possession. Teams were really structured previously, but it was a rigid 4-4-2. I remember when 4-2-3-1 came in and every single team played 4-2-3-1. But it was boring because the two midfielders were always defensive midfielders, weren't they? So basically you had a block of four and two in front and that was it. And you basically just had four attackers doing whatever they wanted. And actually, we're not there. We are seeing more goals, and whether that's because teams are more open at the back or making more mistakes. Part of me thinks that it's because the bottom 6 to 8 teams are much weaker than they maybe would have been in the past, but that's probably because more teams had more average players.
I think everyone's knackered as well. I think the too many games has such a massive effect on how long teams can keep up this structured play. I think that has a huge effect, and I think that's why we see quite a lot of late goals in games at the minute, because they're just knackered. And for all the subs, bring in 6 or 7 more subs if you want, but it's still not going to make a difference with that regard.
Yeah, and the subs thing really annoys me because it means that you're Liverpool and Man City and whatever, who, interestingly, Klopp and Guardiola moan about games being played, and some games will bring 1 sub on or 2 subs. That's an annoying side note, but it is always going to benefit bigger teams because they've got bigger and better squads. Whereas, you know, a Southampton or Ipswich, you're probably running at, 6 to 7 quality Premier League Premier League standard players. Liverpool are probably running at, 18, 19 maybe. So everyone in their squad is a good quality Premier League player. And actually, it benefits them way more.
See, we haven't mentioned Southampton, but I think they're quite an interesting example of this because I know they were taken over by a Serbian billionaire or something like that. And they were going to go down the sort of data-driven approach. But when you have a manager in Russell Mine who has a very, very specific style of play and needs to recruit very specific players to suit that specific style of play, I feel this is not the analytics fault. It's not having a data-driven approach fault. But you're pigeonholing yourself so much where, for me, I prefer my managers to be a bit more tactically flexible. Fantastic to play this way of football. When it works and it comes off, it looks great. It's some beautiful football, but I find it predictable and I think easy for teams to defend against, especially when you're working with lower quality players. So I think that's one of the things where I'm not sure. Can data help you find tactically versatile players who can do a bit of everything? And, you know, from one game to the next, you want to play a different type against, you know, different style of tactic against a team. And next week, we're going to press high this time. Next week, we're going to do the low block. And this is one of the things where I'm not clear on. Maybe that thing does exist, but maybe there are still limitations to it. And it's how you use it, right? It's like anything. It's a platform. It's a tool. It's how you use it to to better your situation.
Yeah, definitely. And for me, with Russell Martin, I think it's actually, I felt this way when he was at Swansea, it's almost like ultra-defensive possession football. Basically, if we've got it, you haven't, therefore you can't score. And I do feel like we're partially entering that kind of era at the minute, whereas I think there's a lot of teams who are sort of saying, it's absolutely fine for you to have the ball because you've got three forwards who are terrible at this level, who aren't going to finish the chances because we've seen their XG and we've seen the conversion rate and they're terrible. So go ahead, have the ball. We've got two wingers who are faster than all of your team who score this amount of goals this season. Off you go. See if you can beat us. And for me, that's where I think Russell Martin, I really, really, like, I don't like him as a manager at all. At all. Really, really don't like him. Yeah. I think he plays...
No, I know quite a few people who have that opinion, actually.
He plays pretty football, but he had one of the best squads in the league in the Championship last season, and they got up through the playoffs. Like, Ipswich, Kieran McKenna. Why are we not talking about Kieran McKenna compared to Russell Martin, who effectively took, like, a League One plus a bit of Championships, like, fairy dust in the couple of transfer windows to second in the league to Leicester. Again, it's that idea of player. For me, it's all about player quality a lot of the time. Russell Martin might be great if you put him in Arsenal's dugout. He might be. Like, he might actually be great, but he would have Saka, Havertz, Rice. I reckon me and you could probably do a decent job with Arsenal. You know what I mean? If we set up in a 4-3 or whatever it was, because actually your players are going to do a lot of the work for you. And that's where I think, like you say, that tactical flexibility. For me, I think I would be looking at how can I use data or information to find out where teams and players' weaknesses are more generally. Like, what is the general weakness of Premier League teams? Is it deep crosses? Is it cutback? What is the area? Because if I haven't got the best players, I'm a mid-ranking team or bottom half team, where am I going to find the best thing? Like, I think if you played 4-4-2 on the ball, I'm not quite sure what teams would do. Like a really aggressive 4-4-2 with overlapping fullbacks and a Sutton Shearer type couple of target forwards up front, managing those three defenders or whatever it was.
This is the thing that's coming back, because football works in cycles, and every 5 to 10 years there is like another cycle again. And while we're in this era of inverted wing backs with, you know, quite high possession and high press, the way against that is counter attacking fast, high balls over the top. We're going to circle back around, and I think especially in an era where, God, children are like bred to be like giants, like the amount of absolute giants that come through. There's gonna be like a reversion back to target men, and they'll realise that because we have such an emphasis on possession now, it means that everyone has smaller defenders. So hey, you just get a bigger striker, lump the ball up to him, he's gonna win headers, and it's how it works. And that's why football's kind of fascinating, because not only is the game itself fluid, but the trends and the tactics and everything that comes with it also must remain fluid. Where that's not the same in other sports. I mean, we were talking about baseball as an example, and I've only been really getting into baseball the last few years, and I've been really enjoying it. But also, I still fail to see where the tactics are. It's just a man throwing the ball to a guy, another man with a stick, and they're hitting it. And I've done the reading, I've read some baseball stuff, and I understand it to a point, but it's still not as like there's no fluidity there. There's no ability to change mid game and to totally change how. The momentum of a match is going to in your benefit. I mean, they still don't really have that. And I think there's certain things that data in football still cannot really account for. I mean, how do you account for Blues? My Blues are a perfect example, where we played Northampton at the weekend, and I think we must have had about 85% possession at the end of it. And then Northampton had a couple of chances, but I think we had at the end of the game, we had a 4.5 XG. Winning 1-0 in the 97th minute. I mean, I'm sure you can guess what happens is that one of their players launches the ball forward, bounces off one of our defenders' back, lands at their left back, who absolutely smashes it into the bottom corner, and the game finishes 1-1. How do you legislate for that? What's the data that you have in place that can prevent that and take into account a lucky bounce, a player slipping, all that sort of stuff? Momentum in how do you quantify momentum? Which is I know people argue against it, but momentum and the sort of the mental impact and the mental fortitude that goes into sport I don't know how you quantify that.
Yeah, I think game state is a very interesting in
game
thing,
state.
Especially with something like XG. So if you're 3-0 up after 20 minutes, you might lose the game on XG. Because when you're 3-0 up, you're naturally going to retreat because you've probably won the game. So for the next 70 minutes, what's the other team going to try and do? Well, they're going to try and score three goals. So they're probably going to have loads of shots. But if you scored three goals in 20 minutes, it's probably likely that your players are better. Therefore, you've got a better goalkeeper, better defender. The shots might... We had 30 shots against Derby this season. 30 in one game. They had about five and they won 1-0. Because our player from our corner tried to kick it back to our keeper. It didn't go far enough. Their striker was running to get it, rounded the keeper and tapped it in. I think
it's one of those ways, like, sure, you might have had 30 shots, but where were those shots coming from? Like, how do you maximise that? How do you make sure that is the shots in the right areas?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing you can't, like, one of our players had 9 shots, and actually, he's not very good.
Was that Bergzog?
It was certainly Bergzog. So he shouldn't be having 9 shots. So my data should be telling me you should not have 9 shots because you're not very good at finishing. Whereas, like, the Birmingham thing, it's like, If the same chances were presented to Man City, they might have won 7-1. But because, you know, Jay Stansfield or Alfie May or Lyndon Dykes or whatever, they're good League One strikers. Stansfield's a good championship striker. Dykes has been a good championship striker, or solid championship striker, shall we say. But he's still probably only going to score, what, 1 in 3 games, 1 in 4 games, maybe? He's going to get 12 goals a season. There you go. So if he's... if he's 1.7 of your XG, I'm not surprised they didn't score. So again, you start going back to player quality because XG doesn't measure a lot of those things, which it can never really do because you'd have to plot every single player, and which they do. But that'd be interesting, wouldn't it? What was the XG of the chance in the Premier League compared to the XG of the chance in League One? Because somebody could definitely do that because they definitely collect individual data for individual leagues. So actually, that should be a reflection on the quality of the level of the league. And maybe this is what Brighton's analytics bods are doing. They're analysing the Ecuadorian league, the Dutch league, the Belgian league, the Japanese league, or whatever.
There is a model, I don't remember the name of it, the one that sort of, when at the end of a season, when, you know, it determining who the European golden boot winner is, and like, as in who scored the most and best goals in Europe. And it's like, how you judge the Eredivisie against the Premier League to the La Liga to the Ligue 1 and all that sort of stuff. There is a model for that. I can't remember what it's called, though.
Yeah, so they used to do... It has multipliers, doesn't it? Like, you know, if you score one goal in the Prem, it's one goal. If you score one goal in... or maybe the Prem might be a multiplier of two, but, or whatever it is. But you've got to score more goals in a weaker league to compete with the top five. Part of me thinks they just don't want unknowns winning the Golden Boot. But that's football, football organisations for you, though, isn't it? So probably sort of conclusion in terms of the data. I think obviously it's way more prevalent in the fan sphere, for better or worse, whether people like it or not. It's going to be there. It's always been there. We've always had possession, shots on target, shots off target, block shots. How many saves did you keep and make? You know, all that kind of stuff. And I think, like I said before, having more knowledge about the game, for me, can't really be a bad thing because you get to understand what you've just watched. Or if you're looking at the opposition, you can see maybe what they've been like in the last 10 games. Do they cross it more? Do they have more shots outside the box? You can actually get a little bit of information about the teams that you want to watch next, maybe. If you were to sort of predict, I don't know, maybe it was to do with TV coverage or the way newspapers or social media writes about things, what might come next, you know, with your knowledge of American sports, what might be the next step for data in football, whether it's from a fan point of view or what we sort of see and digest?
So I reckon there will be a more total separation of recruitment to coaching. So you're going to have your general manager and you're going to have your coaching setup, and the coaching setup will have less and less say over recruitment, I think. I've also, in my spare time, been trying to think of ways how you get a draft into football, and I think it's been quite interesting. But
I'd love that.
That's a discussion for another day. In terms of football coverage and commentary, I think it's inevitable that we try in this country to turn our media more and more like American, and how they cover sports with the acronyms and the data and all that sort of stuff. Not necessarily a bad thing. Awful country, but the way that they cover sports is absolutely fascinating and kind of thrilling. And if you just sit down and listen to like American radio, or listen to them talk about you know, sports for a date. It's incredible. I don't know how they get so much airtime out of the topics when they're just regurgitating the same points over and over again. But it's absolutely fascinating. I can see that coming here. I think in this country, there's too much of an emphasis on players. So Sky Sports will always hire ex-players when really there are so many more people out there who can interpret this data in a much more interesting way, offer a bit more commentary. And I think if we lean a bit further away from that into experts rather than ex-players, I think that could be quite interesting for coverage on TV. But I don't see that happening anytime soon. So yeah, I think that's my bold prediction. It was not that bold really, but especially for the separation of recruitment from coaching, and managers will be forced into, especially at the top level, they'll have no say over recruitment whatsoever. They just have to work with it. And actually, part of that, I think, may be that we get to a stage where not just the manager is a spokesperson for a club. So at the minute now, you'll have, who's a good example? Arsenal. I know Edu has just left, but Edu has had as much influence over that team as Mikel Arteta did for Arsenal. But it's only ever Mikel Arteta will ever see in interviews and in front of TV and offering expert analysis. We never ever hear from the sporting director or the general manager over the court. But I think that might change. I think we might have to get to a point where they have as much opinion, and you need to hear from them as much as you do the manager or head coach.
Yeah, we've probably got 21st century organisations with the 20th century fan base at times who don't want to hear from that because they still think the manager is the one calling all the shots, when actually on the continent that hasn't been the case for decades. And actually we're probably just catching up with, you know, the likes of Serie A and La Liga have always had, you know, administrators in the background. I mean, Barcelona, the president elections was built on, if you elect me, I will sign this player, not who my manager wants. I'm going to bring you Ronaldinho. Do you remember Beckham was going to Barcelona? I think they were saying we're going to sign Beckham because we want blah, blah, blah. And actually we may well get to that point.
The fascinating ones were, Athletic Club Bilbao a few years ago, when if they were going to bring one director in, he was going to bring back Marcelo Bielsa, and the other one was, no, I'll bring back Ernesto Valverde. And amazing that they had these agreements in place already, and they were just Bielsa and Valverde just sitting around waiting for them to have this election, so if they knew if they got the job or not. Incredible.
Yeah, it's mad, isn't it? And I think that is something that we might end up seeing. Again, with these podcasts, we try and sort of chat through some of these issues and give some of our opinions and thoughts on some of these things. But if you do have your own thoughts, views, opinions, do share them with us on social media. We're more than happy to talk about that. I've already got an idea for another little podcast series within the game, which is definitely going to be around how we get a draft into modern football, absolutely, how we change the academy systems. We'll do a whole maybe series of what if podcasts maybe on the horizon. So if you've enjoyed listening, please do let us know. Do all the usual like, share, rate and review and all that sort of stuff. And from both of us, thank you very much.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.